Hey, how is everybody? Back from spring break, right? Yeah, it was a whole week off. Yeah, it would be nice to have another week, that's for sure. Catch up on all the study and all those other little chores we got to do. All right, anybody do anything really amazing, fun, dangerous, exciting over spring break? Like you just got out of jail this morning or something? No? Nothing that exciting? Yeah, me neither. Yeah. Okay. So how is that? All right, so the recorder's working. Everything is online for you guys. We are just going to finish up something on the visual system today and then move into endocrinology. Today is April 7th, and this is Bio 241. And let's take a look at the schedule. And it's shown on the right-hand side. Fantastic. All right, so done with exam number two. That was the week before spring break. Got spring break. Today is the 7th. All right, and we're going to get into endocrinology chapter. So 1 week from today, there's a lecture. 2 weeks from today, there's a lecture. Ah, but look at that. 2.5 weeks, April 23rd, that's your third exam. On chapters 10, 11, 12, and 13. Pay attention to when I announce this in class. That may or may not change. I'm not sure. Right? So always pay attention. Hopefully we can get through chapter 13. Question? Yeah, but then 13 gets jammed onto this last test, and I don't know if that's any better. So we'll... Oh, make sure you keep coming to lecture, right? Because right now, what's scheduled on exam 3 is 10, 11, 12, and 13, but that might change, right? If we can't get all the way through chapter 13, then maybe I'll say maybe half of 13 or certain page numbers or something like that. I'm not sure, right? So always come, because this is a tentative lecture schedule. But so far, I think we're doing pretty good. All right, anybody got a question on the schedule at all? All right, then on the last day, May 21st, that's your last exam. That's just a regular exam. It's not a cumulative final. All right, so let's go to today's lecture. Going to finish up the visual system. And we ended right around here someplace last time. And so this is the visual system. We see, let me get my cursor going. Where is it? Here it is. Pointer options, arrow options, visible. Okay. All right, so on this slide, you see some photoreceptor cells. Do you see any photoreceptor cells? I see light, right? These arrows in this yellow area represents light. Here's the direction of light coming into the eye. Do you see any photoreceptor cells on this slide? Yes. Okay. And where are they? What are they called? How many are there? Yeah, rods and cones. Okay, and the slide is a little bit funny because the cones actually should be smaller than the rods. The rods should be bigger, and I think that's an important consideration because the rods are more sensitive to light than the cones, and that's just because they're bigger, right? If one little packet of light, quantum of light comes in, the rod cell is much bigger, can capture that packet of light and start the visual system, but this cone is so small, that little packet of light might miss it altogether, right, and won't cause any action potentials going to the brain. All right, so the other thing you should know, what is the rod cell responsible for? We said it is sensitive to light. But what kind of light? Black and white. Yeah, so it's grayscale. All right, and so we said that the cone cells are not very sensitive to light, but what do they detect that a rod cell can't? Color, right? And also because they're small, they give you high resolution. They give you fine detail. So you can see nice sharp edges with cone cells, which you cannot see with the rod. So they both have their function. Which ones are in your central vision? The cones, that's right. Your color, sharp vision is in your central vision. In your peripheral vision, you have a blurry grayscale vision. All right, so two different kinds of cells. Well, for the remainder of this chapter, we're just going to talk about how the rod cells function. We're not going to talk very much about how the cone cells function, so we're just going to relate this discussion to the rod cells. So there is a chemical called rhodopsin in the discs of those rod cells, and rhodopsin has the ability to absorb light energy. right? And when it absorbs light energy, that energy is used to change the shape of some molecules, right? And of course, when you change the shape of a molecule, you change the function that molecule is performing. All right, so in a rod cell, there is a compound called rhodopsin. Rhodopsin has two components. It has an opsin molecule, almost looks like an enzyme because I see it has something on the surface that reminds me of an active site. Yeah, exactly. And that active site has a particular shape, and what can fit into that active site is a compound called cis-retinol. All right, so retinol is just a form of vitamin D, and retinol can have a couple of configurations. Here I see there's a sharp bend in the tail of a retinol, and if we look at the one on the bottom, we see that it's a nice linear sequence, right? So there's a change in shape. The one that's bent, right here we call cis-retinol, and when it's bent, it can fit into the active site. What changes the conformation of cis-retinol is a photon of light. When it absorbs that light energy, right, it starts to wiggle around a little bit more, vibrate, and it can go into what we call an all-trans configuration. And it just so happens that it is linear. And it so no longer fits into the active site of opsin. And that's a result of this light energy hitting the rhodopsin molecule. And when this happens, it causes changes in permeability to the rod cells, to various ions like sodium. And what happens to a cell if we change the permeability of ions across the cell membrane? It's like one of the most important things, right? It changes the membrane potential, And there's a really nice equation that describes that, but that's too much math for this class, so we didn't get into it. Right, but when we change the permeability of a cell membrane to various ions, then the voltage across the membrane changes. And what can you tell me, how could that membrane potential change? You know two words. Yeah, if it's excitatory, what's happening electrically?
It's depolarization.
Yeah, depolarization, right? Or it could be hyperpolarization, and that's going to inhibit the cell. Exactly. Right? So we're just going to use some of those concepts that we used already. All right, so there's going to be some generator potentials produced, and generated potentials, if they summate, where there are voltage-gated channels, and that can trigger an action potential, right, if they all add up, if they summate to the threshold voltage, and then those action potentials go to the brain, your visual center in particular. All right, so this reaction, when the rhodopsin or the retinol, the cis-retinol changes into the trans-retinol configuration, we call that a bleaching reaction. And it takes a while sometimes for the all-trans retinol to go back to the cis-retinol conformation. And when that happens, that's what produces an after image, right? So have you ever had your picture taken and there's a flash, a flash goes off, and then you look away from the camera, and what do you see? You still see the flash hanging in your vision, right? And that's because this all-trans retinol, right, hasn't gone back to the cis-retinol condition, and that's still producing what we call an after image. So this bleaching reaction, right, lasts a little while. All right, so here's a slide that I don't want to spend a lot of time on now because it's really hard to understand. But here is an important statement. All right, visual transduction is inverse of other sensory systems. All right, so that, I think, is the key point on this particular slide. It will make sense after we look at a few diagrams. All right, so what do you understand to be an excitatory event on a cell in terms of membrane potential? Membrane potential, what's excitatory to that cell? Yeah, it becomes, the inside of the cell becomes more positive. We call that depolarization. Yeah, depolarization, and that is excitatory. Right, so usually we like to think that when there is stimulus presence, right, that's going to cause depolarization, that's going to excite the cell. Right, so stimulus, depolarization, excitation. That's not necessarily what happens in the visual system. Right, so let's take a look and see what's going on. Right, rods and cones contain many sodium channels. that are open. So what does that mean if a sodium channel is open on any kind of cell? If a sodium channel is open, it is, you guys know this, it depolarizes, which is what? An excitatory event, right? But when does that happen in the visual system? In light conditions or dark conditions? Dark conditions, right? So that is pretty strange. So in the absence of stimulus, the rod and cone cells are excited. Right? They are excited because they're depolarizing because these sodium channels are open. So that is a little bit strange. Right? So in the absence of stimulus, that sodium influx is what we call a dark current because sodium is an electrically charged particle. It's entering the cell. And since it's bringing that positive charge in, that's an electrical current. And when does that happen? In the dark. Right? So that's what we call a dark current. Light, on the other hand, hyperpolarizes. All right, so hyperpolarization is inhibitory to that cell, and it does that by closing the sodium channels that are open in the dark. So you got to flip your understanding of receptors a little bit. So let's take a look and see how on earth could that possibly be. All right, so here we see a cell. Here I see a disc inside of a rod cell. Attached to this disc is a cis retinol, and retinol is in a cis conformation. Under what conditions, dark or light? In the dark, yeah. All right, so this is in the absence of stimulus, right? This opsin is in a nice linear form. And right next to it is going to be a G protein. And you know, G proteins can trigger various other kinds of events inside of a cell, can turn an enzyme on, can turn an enzyme off, right? It can open ion channels or close ion channels. Let's look and see what it has to do with a rod cell. So here's that G protein, the three subunits, alpha, beta, and gamma. In the dark, the G protein is all put together on this disc along with the cis retinol. There is an enzyme floating around in the cytosol, which is a phosphodiesterase. Maybe once upon a time in this class we talked about a phosphodiesterase, but for sure we talked about adenylate cyclase. Anybody remember what adenylate cyclase does? Adenylate cyclase? Yeah, it does something with AM. AMP. AMP, we're really good. Okay, so what does it actually do? Fortunately, I can remember. Okay, so what it does, adenylate cyclase takes an ATP, which is in a nice linear form, right, and it chops off two phosphate groups, and you end up with AMP, adenosine monophosphate, but a special form, a cyclic form of AMP. And that's called, cyclic AMP. That's what adenylate cyclase does. Right? Adenylate cyclase makes cyclic AMP from ATP. And that cyclic AMP can be a second messenger inside the cell. It can trigger other things. All right, well, here's another nucleotide very similar to adenosine, and that is guanine. Right? And guanine can be converted into a cyclic form with an enzyme that's similar to adenylate cyclase. All right, but that's half the story. So what's an important, how should you think of control systems if you're going to have precise control and balance of some kind of operating system? What should be built into that? Antagonism, that's right. So if there is an enzyme that makes cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP, what would you expect to find? Yeah, one that takes it apart. And that's what I was trying to get to. That's the phosphodiesterase, right? So phosphodiesterase counteracts the effects of that cyclase enzyme. All right, so in the dark conditions, phosphodiesterase is inactive. So if there is any cyclic AMP or cyclic GMP in the cell, it's just going to remain inside the cell. It won't get broken down, right? And that's in the dark condition. All right, let's move over to the cell membrane. So here we have the plasma membrane. And again, this is in the dark. Here is a sodium channel that the nucleus built and put inside the cell membrane. And so when this particular sodium channel, right, binds cyclic GMP, it is open. And this is a sodium channel. So if the sodium channel is open because cyclic GMP has bound to this receptor site, what happens to sodium? rushes inside the cell because sodium is high outside, it's low inside. And when sodium rushes inside the cell because cyclic GMP is high, what happens to the membrane potential? It depolarizes, right? Which you know to be an excitatory event under what conditions? The dark conditions. I know it's kind of a mind teaser, but I think I maybe described it almost pretty well. All right. Now, so what happens when we turn a light on? We shine light on this cis retinol. What happens to it? Absorbs some of that energy, right? That's like your friend poking you in the side. You're going to change conformation. It changes to an all-trans configuration, dissociates from the opsin molecule, which activates this G protein so the alpha subunit can start to wander around inside the cytosol. It's going to bump into all kinds of things, including the inactive phosphodiesterase. And when it does, it activates the phosphodiesterase. And what's the job of a phosphodiesterase to break down? Yeah, to break down cyclic forms of, like, cyclic GMP. So now you have regular old GMP. Since the shape has changed, it can no longer bind to the sodium channel receptor. When it comes off, the sodium channel closes. And when you close the sodium channel, what happens then? Then you have hyperpolarization, or an inhibitory event happens to this rod cell. All right, so the rod cell becomes inhibited under what kind of conditions? In the light. So in the presence of stimulus, the rod cell becomes inhibited. In the absence of stimulus, the rod cell is excited. All right. So that's kind of half the story. Now, why does that work for us? Why is it that in the presence of stimulus, the rod cell is inhibited? Well, because there's a double negative that's taking place. So here we have a couple rod cells. We got a couple bipolar cells and a ganglion cell. So here's a nice scheme that we see inside of the retina. Remember, bipolar neurons are what we find in special senses, right, like vision, olfaction. That's about the only place where we find these bipolar cells. And we got two conditions. The first column represents without stimulus or in the dark. The second column represents what is going to happen when there is stimulus or when a light is turned on. Okay. Does everybody sort of have a feel for what's happening here? Okay. Two conditions. All right. So in the absence of stimulus, we saw that cyclic GMP is high, because the phosphodiesterase is inactive, right? Because the G proteins are not activated. So cyclic GMP stays around inside the cell, binds to the sodium channel. When it binds to the sodium channel, what happens? Yeah, it opens up, sodium enters the cell, that excites, all right, or depolarizes the rod cell. All right, and then of course you're familiar with the sodium potassium ATP pump. There's some potassium channels, all right, that are open all the time. That's not such a big deal for us to consider right now. So as this cell becomes depolarized, right, well, what usually happens to a neuron when it depolarizes? Does it secrete neurotransmitter, or does it withhold the secretion of neurotransmitter? Yeah, it starts to secrete a neurotransmitter when it depolarizes. So this rod cell depolarizes, secretes a neurotransmitter, and there are receptors for that neurotransmitter on the bipolar cell, but here is the important step. This neurotransmitter is inhibitory. Right? So even though the rod cell is excited, what happens to the bipolar cell? It is inhibited. It means it hyperpolarizes because of the neurotransmitter that's released from the rod cell. And when the bipolar cell is inhibited, the action potentials do not go to the visual center in your brain, and you don't see anything. Okay? So you just have to remember that the rod cell is secreting a neurotransmitter, but the neurotransmitter is inhibitory. And I think you probably remember some schemes, maybe even some neurotransmitters that are inhibitory. Does anybody remember a neurotransmitter that is inhibitory? How about GABA? Okay. And how would that work? By opening up chlorine channel, for instance. Chlorine is high outside, rushes inside the cell, hyperpolarizes, right, the bipolar cell. That would be one good example. All right, so now let's turn the light on. And now the rod cell, right, so now you have activation of that retinol compound, which activates the phosphodiesterase. What happens to cyclic GMP when phosphodiesterase is activated? Yeah, it starts to decrease. Cyclic GMP starts to go away, right? And it comes off of the receptor on that sodium channel. The sodium channel closes. All right, when that sodium channel closes, what happens to the membrane potential? Yeah, it can no longer depolarize. Another way of thinking of that, it hyperpolarizes. And what do you know about hyperpolarization? Inhibitory, it inhibits the release of neurotransmitter from the rod cell. But now what kind of neurotransmitter is that? It's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So in the presence of light, the release of inhibitory neurotransmitter from the rod cell is inhibited. So you have like two negatives there, which means what? The bipolar cell right here then can spontaneously depolarize it by itself because there are sodium leak channels in it. Right? So if the bipolar cell is not inhibited, then it will slowly depolarize, and when it does, it releases excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell, and then that ganglion cell will form action potentials that go to the visual center in your brain. What's the visual lobe? The occipital lobe. Okay, so that's the job with that, and I just want to check, see if I have one last slide, but I think that's pretty much a complete thought, but you probably have some questions, yeah. Okay. There are some cells that will spontaneously depolarize because they have some sodium leak channels in them. Okay? And these sodium leak channels pretty much are never turned off. Sodium is entering this bipolar cell all the time. And so all the time it's going to be depolarizing. And what counteracts that would be an inhibitory neurotransmitter, for instance, that would be opening some chlorine channels. So the sodium that's leaking out is counteracted by the chlorine that's leaking in, right? And that's what would inhibit the bipolar cell. When that inhibition disappears, right, then the bipolar cell depolarizes because sodium is entering it all the time. And then the bipolar cell releases neurotransmitter. Now, this is not an inhibitory neurotransmitter. It is an excitatory neurotransmitter. It produces EPSPs on the ganglion cell. So you'll have to just look at this a little bit before it sort of makes sense to you. All right, so the dark current. What's responsible for the dark current? What kind of molecule is moving? A dark current means something in motion, like an electrical charge is moving. What kind of electrical charge is moving in the dark current? Okay. Yeah, it's a positive charge. Due to what has a positive charge on it? Yeah, sodium. Right. So the dark current is the result of sodium entering the rod cell. In what? The absence of stimulus or the presence of stimulus? Absence of stimulus, so the rod cell becomes excited. But the neurotransmitter that's released by the rod cell is inhibitory on the bipolar cell. So no action potentials go to the brain. Turn stimulus on. What happens to the dark current? It goes away, which means then that inhibitory neurotransmitter from the rod cell disappears, which means then that the bipolar cell becomes activated, becomes stimulated. It releases excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell. Right. And those are just produced graded potentials, and so the job of the ganglion cell is to generate action potentials based on the amount of graded potentials, and that goes to the visual center. So that's kind of a different system, right? And that's what these two slides over here were talking about. But you have to look at the pictures first, I'm sure, before you understand what these slides are all about. So let me read this point right here. Visual transduction is inverse of other sensory systems. Do you see what that means? Yeah. It means that in the absence of stimulus, the rod cell is excited. In the presence of stimulus, the rod cell is inhibited, which is kind of strange, right? So in the dark, photoreceptors release inhibitory neurotransmitter that hyperpolarizes the bipolar cells. Can you relate to that diagram of where that bipolar cell is? Right? Light, on the other hand, inhibits photoreceptors from releasing that neurotransmitter. From what cell? What cell releases inhibitory neurotransmitter? the rod cell, right? So in the presence of stimulus or light, the rod cell no longer secretes inhibitory neurotransmitter, thus stimulating the bipolar cells. Does that sort of make sense? Okay. Look it over a couple times, and maybe next time in class, ask me some questions, or office hours, something like that. All right, so that's a really nice curveball. If you guys can track that, you deserve a professional contract. That's great. All right, but you'll have to look at it more than one time, I'm sure. Okay, how about questions? Anybody have a question? All right, you just got to start with a basic understanding that depolarization is excitatory. How does that happen? Sodium entering a cell. And hyperpolarization is inhibitory. Of course, the other thing you should realize is that some neurotransmitters are excitatory, some are inhibitory, depending on what kind of channels are opening or closing. All right, and you have to kind of use everything we've learned so far to have a good sense of what's happening there. Okay, any other question? All right, well, now we're going to move on to something that you're a whole lot more familiar with, and that is the endocrine system, because you all had anatomy. And which means that you learned something about the endocrine system, maybe learned about some hormones. Okay, what kind of gland secretes a hormone? I'll probably talk about it in here somewhere along the line. Ah, look at this first slide. What kind of gland secretes a hormone? An endocrine gland, that's right. Now what the heck is an endocrine gland? Who can tell me something about the morphology of an endocrine gland? It has something to do with ducts or tubes. That's right. It's a ductless gland. All right. So an endocrine gland produces a product, right, like a hormone, secretes that hormone. That's another important thing that an endocrine gland can do, can secrete it from the cell. All right. And then what happens to that secretion? It gets picked up by the circulatory system, right? And once it's in the circulatory system, where does it go? All over the place, right? And when it gets to a distant location, it can leave the circulatory system, basically by just concentration gradient, by diffusion. When it leaves the circulatory system, it has to bind to a receptor, right, on that distant tissue, and when it binds to that receptor, it changes the physiology of that cell or that tissue. All right, so if a cell or a tissue has a receptor, we call it a target tissue. All right, a tissue can't be a target tissue if it doesn't have receptors because it will have no idea that the hormone is anywhere in the neighborhood. It's got to have a receptor. All right, so endocrine glands are ductless glands. They secrete hormones into the bloodstream. All right, and what kind of vessel will a hormone enter the bloodstream? I heard that. I like that. A capillary. Right, so think of some structure of a capillary. It's just thin, and it's kind of leaky, right? It's thin, so things can enter or leave a capillary. We call that exchange because of that structure, right? And that's the same reason why a hormone can leave the circulatory system. And again, it's only through a capillary because it has a very thin wall. Hormones go to a target cell, all right? And it's a target cell if what? It's got to have a receptor. That's right. It has no receptor, can't be a target cell or target tissue. Right? And then when it binds, it changes the physiology of that cell somehow. And we'll take a look at how that happens. Different hormones work a little bit different ways. And you're going to really like this because it has to do whether they're hydrophilic or hydrophobic. All right. Neurohormones. So what the heck is a neurohormone? A neurohormone is secreted by something that's not strictly an endocrine gland. It's secreted by a neuron, right? So it has electrical properties as well, but this particular neuron doesn't secrete that transmitter into the synaptic cleft. It just secretes it into the extracellular space, which then gets it's picked up by the blood, and then it's delivered everywhere in the body. All right, so neurohormones are secreted into the blood by specialized neurons. Oh, it says right there. Okay, and in every case, a hormone or a neurohormone will change the metabolism of a target tissue or a target cell. But that's kind of a loaded term, because what does a target cell mean? It's got to have a receptor, right? It's got to have a receptor for it. And how would you explain the binding of a hormone to a receptor someplace? Yeah, it's by shape, right? Specific shape, maybe electrical charge in there. Okay. So here's a table of a number of glands in the body. And you'll see some kind of funny ones here. Ah, would you consider the heart an endocrine gland? Okay, you have to be really well educated to say yes to that. Usually you think of the heart as being a pump and it just pressurizes blood so that it flows around. But the heart can help adjust blood pressure, right, because it can secrete a hormone called atrial natriuretic hormone. Right, and so what part of the heart secretes atrial natriuretic hormone? The atria in particular. And what do you know about this natri? What do you know about natrium? Natrium. Natrium, natrium, natrium. That's the base word where Na, which is sodium, comes from. Okay, so natriuretic has to do with the secretion of sodium into the urine. Okay, and where are we right here? Heart. It goes, so natriuretic hormone, the target tissue is the kidneys, and it promotes the excretion of sodium in the urine, right? And when sodium is concentrated in the urine, that will draw water into urine, that will produce a greater volume of urine. So what happens to blood volume as you are urinating more? It starts to go down. That's right. And as it goes down, we're going to see in the next chapter, your blood pressure goes down. So here's a way that there's one mechanism that controls blood pressure in your body. Okay. So yes, we have some strange endocrine glands and we're going to become familiar with. Some are really obvious, right? Like adrenal medulla, hypothalamus, you probably learned of some of these things, ovaries, right? Testes, for instance, thyroid gland. But here is a list of a whole bunch of different endocrine glands that maybe we're not so familiar with. Now, what did I want to show you here? What's important? If you want to have precise control and balance over some important function in your body, how should it be controlled? Via some antagonistic properties, right? What's one important molecule in your body that's regulated all the time in your bloodstream?
Glucose,
that's right. All right, so, and it just so happens that there are glucose receptors in the pancreas, and the pancreas can respond by secreting a couple hormones. And here we have insulin and glucagon from the islets of Langerhans. Right, so insulin will decrease blood glucose, glucagon will increase blood glucose. So I think maybe you should look down this list and actually find some of these antagonistic pairs. What's maybe another one? Parathyroid hormone. Do I have calcitonin on here? It's left off this list, but it should be on it. Up. Thyroid. Here, calcitonin. Okay. All right, so where's parathyroid hormone? Okay, increases the concentration of calcium in the blood. Calcitonin decreases concentration of calcium in the blood. Okay, so we're going to look at some of these things. And you just might want to circle them on this table as maybe we're talking about them. So let's classify some hormones. And I think you should know whether these are hydrophilic or hydrophobic. It will depend on, if that will determine what kind of world it likes to dissolve in, whether it's a water world or a lipid world. Amine hormones, derived from tyrosine tryptophan, they include norepinephrine. Epinephrine. What do you know about epinephrine? It's probably one of your favorite neurotransmitters, but here we're going to say that it is a hormone, okay? Because it's going to be secreted by a neuron. Thyroxine is an amine. Melatonin is one. Some are long proteins or peptides, like antidiuretic hormone. What kind of meaning does antidiuretic hormone mean to you? What does it do? It helps you retain water, conserve water, right? It reduces urine volume, right? So you retain water. What's going to happen to blood pressure if you retain water? It will have a tendency to go up, right? That's the next chapter. Growth hormone, insulin, oxytocin, glucagon, adrenal corticotropic hormone, parathyroid hormone, these are all peptide hormones. And peptide hormones, are they hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Yeah, they're hydrophilic, right? So they like to dissolve in water. Some are glycoproteins, like luteinizing hormone, thyroid stimulating hormone. These are also hydrophilic hormones. And then there are a whole bunch that are steroids. And what's the precursor molecule to steroid hormones? Yeah, fats. But I would like to be particular and say cholesterol. And indeed, cholesterol is a fat. Oh, it says right here, right? They're all derived from cholesterol. Right, so some important sex hormones like testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, and then some other hormones that help regulate glucose metabolism like cortisol and also sodium and potassium metabolism like aldosterone. Right, those are all steroids. And those are hydrophobic. Yeah. Okay, here is cholesterol. So we're going to see that we're going to build with various metabolic pathways some steroid hormones. All right, so there are small modifications to cholesterol. Let us just look at testosterone and estradiol, right, or estrogen. All right, so would you think that there would be a major change? They have really radical differences inside your body, right? Boys versus girls, is there a difference? Yeah, absolutely. So would you expect a big change in that molecule between a testosterone and an estrogen? No. Small changes in the shape of a molecule can change what? Have major changes in its function. And so what's the difference? This one hydrogen atom right here, right? And these all are derived from cholesterol. Progesterone, female sex hormone, right, is a precursor to cortisol, which is involved with glucose metabolism. Okay, so that's the important thing that I wanted you to see on this slide, that small changes in a molecule can cause major changes in the function of what that molecule is. Okay, thyroxine, or hormone from the thyroid gland, because of these ring structures right here, are hydrophobic, lipophilic. And there is something interesting on this molecule. I see a lot of carbons and hydrogens, nitrogen. These are pretty common kinds of atoms to find in biological molecules. But there's also an atom that is uncommon. Does anybody see an uncommon atom on these two hormones? I see T4 and T3 over here. I see, what do I see? I see an iodine, okay? So thyroxine has four of these iodines. We call that tetraiodothreonine. And this is mostly what's secreted by the thyroid gland, but when it enters a cell, one of these iodines come off, and that becomes triiodothreonine. And no one ever takes time to say that. They just say T3, right? So T4 and T3. You should know what I'm talking about. T3 is the active form of thyroid hormone inside the cell. Okay. And since it is lipophilic, can it enter the cell or is it stuck outside? If it is lipophilic, what can you tell me about the inside of a membrane? Is it lipophilic or hydrophilic inside the membrane? It is lipophilic, which means lipids can enter the cell membrane and move across it, right? So T3 and T4 can move inside the cell because it can move right through the cell membrane, right? And if it can move inside the cell, where should the receptor be? Yeah, the receptor can be inside the cell. It doesn't have to be extracellular. All right, so that's going to be important consideration. Some common aspects of neuroendocrine regulation. Okay, so we're going to compare and contrast. So the nervous system and endocrine system use chemicals to communicate. If it's purely conceptually a nervous system, then it's going to communicate with neurotransmitters. If it's an endocrine system, it's going to communicate with hormones. Right? The difference between neurotransmitters and hormones is just the mode of transport. A hormone is in the blood. Right, neurotransmitter is just by diffusion across the synaptic cleft. right? And there's more diversity of effects in hormone targets compared to neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters basically can only cause EPSPs or IPSPs, one or the other, right? But hormones can have a whole bunch of different array of effects. We're going to look at some of those effects. Right, there are some chemicals that are used both as hormones and neurotransmitters. Does anybody right now know an example of a signaling molecule that could be a hormone and a neurotransmitter, depending on where it's secreted? Yeah, epinephrine is a good one. Norepinephrine is a good example of that. Okay. And as a matter of fact, I was going to think of something else, but the other one is purely a neurohormone. What's purely a neurohormone is antidiuretic hormone. Antidiuretic hormone is secreted by a neuron, but it acts like a hormone inside the body. Something that they both have in common, neurotransmitters and hormones have to bind to a receptor, which is based on the shape, and then that's going to change something about that cell, maybe the membrane potential or some metabolism inside the cell. And there has to be a way to rapidly inactivate them both. Right? So they can't, once a neurotransmitter is secreted, they can't exist in the synaptic cleft forever, because then that would basically poison that particular synapse. The same thing for receptors for hormones. They have to be degraded sometime. All right, some interactions between hormones. Well, we said sometimes they're antagonistic to each other. One hormone inhibits the effect of the other, like insulin and glucagon, parathyroid hormone, calcitonin. Sometimes two hormones are synergistic if they produce the same effects. And an important concept with synergism is that if we look at the effect of one hormone, or the magnitude of the effect of one hormone, and the magnitude of the effect of a second hormone, right, if we add those two together, it's greater. The effect is greater than the sum of the two individual effects. Right, so it's going to be much greater. That's what we mean by synergism. There are other cases where there's a permissive effect. Right, so one hormone might increase the responsiveness to a second hormone, or a second hormone can only have an effect if a first hormone is around. Right, so if there is a receptor that is going to be responsible or have a produce a response to two hormones, how many active sites does it have to have? Yeah, it has to have two, right? And both of those active sites, right, have to be occupied. Okay. Well, let's look at some ways we can think about hormone action. And a receptor has something like an active site, right? So when we looked at enzymes and when we looked at ligand-gated channels, we talked about something of specificity, right? And what does that mean? What does specificity mean for a receptor? The shape has to match almost perfectly, right? So if there's a change in shape, right, then it loses specificity and the receptor won't become activated. High affinity just means because the shapes are so perfect, you need very low concentrations of neurotransmitters or hormones in the body to have an effect. Right? And low capacity for a particular hormone just means that because there is high affinity, which is a result of specificity, you don't need to have large concentrations of hormones inside your body to control physiology in target tissues. Okay, so low capacity. And you're going to look at a vascular system that enhances that low capacity even further, a special portal system. Anybody remember what a portal system is? Portal blood system? Portal blood? Portal is where you have an artery and a capillary, right? Exchange takes place. And then usually you have a vein bringing it back to the heart, bringing blood back to the heart. But in a portal system, what do you have? Something that looks like a vein and then another capillary. Right, and then a vein that takes the blood back to the heart. So that's kind of a door-to-door delivery system. So a hormone sometimes is picked up by capillary bed number one, leaves that blood vessel capillary bed number two, and then the concentration of that hormone is not diluted by the volume of all the blood in your body. All right, so lipophilic hormones have receptors in the cytoplasm. Because why?
Lipophilic hormones can diffuse through the cell membrane, right? Or maybe it will have a receptor inside the nucleus. What's inside the nucleus? What's the nucleus responsible for? It contains all the information on how to build all the structures inside of a cell, which means it has the information to control all the functions inside the cell. Right, so a hormone then can change the function inside of a cell by affecting transcription, by what kind of proteins are going to be made. Right? And we call that the genomic action. So some hormones act on various genes. And of course, if it's going to activate a gene, then what are the two steps involved in making a protein? Translation and transcription. Did I say it in the right order, or did I kind of mess that up? Which is the first one? What step happens first? Transcription happens first, and then translation. And where does transcription take place? In the nucleus. Where does translation take place? Yeah, so a different location altogether. All right, so you think that's a really lightning fast kind of mechanism, or might it take some time? It takes a little bit of time. Right? All right, so the genomic action for lipophilic hormones takes a little while to have an effect inside your body. Okay, receptors for water solubles. Since these water soluble hormones can't get inside the cell, the receptor has to be on the plasma membrane surface, on the exterior side of that membrane. And since it can't enter this, since that hormone then is a first messenger, then a second messenger has to arise inside the cell. Usually these effects are quick. Right? Maybe it's going to open up an ion channel or some other kind of turn an enzyme on, right, or turn an enzyme off, and usually these are relatively quick. And there are some steroids that act on cell surface receptors, and they don't affect transcription or protein synthesis. They have some other kind of action inside the cell. We call that the non-genomic action of some steroid hormones if the receptor is extracellular. Okay. Okay, just a general comment. If a system takes a long time to become activated, usually the duration of activation is long. Right, so if it takes a long time to become activated, the duration of action is long. If a system is activated very rapidly, then the duration is very short. That's usually just a law of the universe, and I don't know if anybody can explain that, but that's just something that always seems to happen. Right, like there are some drugs, maybe some barbiturates, that have a very fast onset of action, but what will be the duration inside somebody will be very short, right? Some drugs might take a long time to have an effect, maybe minutes, or maybe 10, 15 minutes, half hour, something like that, but what will be the duration of action? Much, much longer, okay? So that just seems to be a law that you should kind of just file in the back of your mind, okay? All right, so here are some hormones. Right, lipid hormones travel in the blood. Now, since they're lipid hormones, do they like to dissolve in blood? No, because blood is an aqueous environment. So here is a carrier protein, and the carrier protein dissolves in blood very easily, and there is a site that can bind a hormone, a lipophilic hormone, and hence that lipophilic hormone can dissolve in blood because of this carrier protein right here. And I can't forget what kind of carrier proteins. They're not albumins, globulins, probably a globulin of some kind, okay? All right, and so there's always going to be some equilibrium established between the hormone that's freely floating in the blood and the majority that's bound to the carrier protein, right? Some are going to be jumping on, but just as many jump on that jump off, so the amount that's on this carrier protein pretty much stays the same. When there is a cell membrane, this hormone can enter the cell, and here is a cytoplasmic receptor. The hormone can bind to the cytoplasmic receptor. The complex of the hormone and receptor can move into the nucleus, right? We call that translocation, can diffuse into the nucleus, And then this hormone receptor complex can bind to a activation site on a DNA molecule, which will initiate transcription of the DNA. All right, so when transcription is initiated, what's the product of transcription? RNA, right, is going to produce RNA, and in particular, in this case, messenger RNA. And what can your body do with a messenger RNA? It can use it as the dictionary for translation, how to build a particular protein. All right, so this hormone right here, right, eventually ends up producing different kinds of proteins inside the cell, right? And of course, that's going to change the physiology of the cell. All right, so that is the effect that the steroid hormone has. Sometimes we say it acts as a transcription factor because it can activate various genes inside of the cell. And remember, that takes a long time. So these receptors are what we call nuclear hormone receptors. Because where is their action? Their action is inside the nucleus, right? And they only will work if they bind their respective hormone. Okay, so that's the genomic effect of some hormones. I think we're going to have to look at some nuclear hormone receptors, right? So when they bind their particular hormones, they're called transcription factors, and that can activate transcription when it binds to a gene. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of different kinds of transcription factors, right? In the steroid family of hormones, and that even includes vitamin D that we looked at before, and retinoic acid. Okay. All right, so these receptors have two domains. Here is the ligand binding domain, this, and ligand would be the hormone. So here is the part of the nuclear hormone receptor that binds the hormone, and then here is a DNA binding domain. Right, that binds to the DNA molecule. So when hormone binds to the ligand binding domain, this thing then can enter the nucleus. The DNA binding domain can bind to what we call the hormone response element. This is at the beginning of a gene. And we see that there are two half sites. Right? And what that means is that in order for this gene right here to be transcribed, both of these sites have to be bound with a transcription factor. And in this particular case, right, the hormone on the left is the same on the right. The hormone response element is exactly the same. We call this homodimerization. Dimerization means what? Two things coming together. Right? And since these are exactly the same, this is an example of homodimerization that will activate this gene. It becomes transcribed, and then various proteins can be made as a result of that. Well, since this is a homodimerization, you might be saying, well, gee whiz, it doesn't have to be. What happens if the hormone response element, right, is different? Then we call that heterodimerization. And that explains why sometimes you don't need just one hormone, but you need two hormones, right, that can act synergistically or have a permissive effect of the first hormone because of these dimerization sites. Yeah. Okay. So here we have two sites on the hormone response element on a DNA molecule, two half sites, right, and they're going to bind two receptor proteins. And they could be the same, right? If they bind the same hormone, that would be called homodimerization. But sometimes they're different, right? So the active site is going to be different, in which case there have to be two different hormones in order to activate this transcription site, and that's called heterodimerization. And so if you have a site that needs heterodimerization, but you'll only have one hormone, what happens to transcription? It won't happen, okay? Until that second hormone comes around, and then that is what we call the permissive effect of that second hormone, right? So now transcription can take place in the presence of the first hormone, but the second one also has to be there as well, okay? could be synergistic or permissive. Yeah. I think I talked about all this already. Okay. All right, so the effect right here is going to be inside the nucleus on DNA. So what kind of hormone will have this kind of effect? Is it going to be a hydrophilic or hydrophobic kind of hormone? Hydrophobic, right? It's got to be a lipid hormone. Can you give me a general class of hormones that are lipids? Like steroid hormones. That's right. So steroid hormones, right, work like transcription factors inside the nucleus. Okay, here is another. It's not a steroid hormone, right? But a thyroid hormone has those hydrocarbon rings. The thyroid gland secretes mostly T4, which is thyroxin, and a little bit of T3. So what does that T stand for? T4, T3, the number of iodines that are on that molecule, right? T4 in the blood is bound to a carrier protein. We call that thyroid binding globulin. Oh, good. I remember that is a globulin, right? There are different kinds of proteins in the blood, a globulin. But only the free T4 can enter the cell. So the thyroid binding globulin, when it's bound to T4, acts like a reservoir for T4. And as T4 enters the cell, then some of the T4 bound to thyroid binding globulin is released back into the blood because of that equilibrium. We call that what? Le Chatelier's principle. Right? If all of a sudden we increase the concentration of T4 in the blood, more will bind to thyroid binding globulin. As we decrease the concentration of T4 in the blood, then the T4 will be released from thyroid binding globulin because of the law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle. All right, and then once inside the cell, and remember, only the free T4 can enter cells because it's lipophilic. T3 is converted into T3, and then T3 binds to the receptor protein located inside the nucleus. So T3 actually translocates right inside the nucleus, right? And it acts as a transcription factor. So here, let's look at this particular scheme. So here we have a receptor, nuclear receptor, and it has a particular shape that can bind retinoic acid. Right? And here is another hormone response element that can bind triiodothreonine. Both of these have to become activated to bind to the hormone response element. Remember, it has two half sites. And when it does, then it can be a transcription factor and initiate transcription of this DNA molecule. All right, so since these units right here are different, this is what we call heterodimerization. And retinoic acid will have a permissive effect of T3 inside the cell. Without retinoic acid, even though there's plenty of triiodothreonine, it won't be able to initiate transcription. So that's a nice way to understand a permissive effect of one hormone on another. All right, so let's move to another class of hormones. All right, and these are water-soluble hormones, hydrophilic. So can they enter a cell? Hydrophilic, cannot enter a cell, so the receptor has to be extracellular. Right, so water-soluble hormones have to bind to cell surface receptors because they can't get through the cell membrane. Right, and since they're always outside the cell, we can consider them a first messenger. When they bind to the receptor, then that produces a second messenger inside the cell, and then that second messenger produces the effect inside the cell, changes the metabolism of the cell. All right, so here is activation of adenylate cyclase. We talked about adenylate cyclase before. What does adenylate cyclase do? Yeah, it takes an ATP and makes, cyclic AMP out of it. That's got a special shape. And so cyclic AMP is a second messenger inside the cell. It's always inside the cell. What is outside the cell? The first messenger in this particular case is a hormone. So hormone binds to the receptor Right, the receptor is coupled with a G protein, so we call this a G protein coupled receptor. Right, the G protein dissociates and can wander around inside the plasma membrane or right on the surface of the plasma membrane when a hormone binds to the receptor. And in this particular case, one of the subunits, the alpha subunit, will bump into adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase by itself is inactive. When the alpha unit is bound to it, then it becomes an active enzyme. Okay, so just whenever this alpha binds to adenylate cyclase, that changes the shape of the molecule, right? It might only be a minor change, you know, like if somebody were to poke you in the side, you'd change body position a little bit, right? So then ATP is converted into cyclic AMP, right? So there is a special thing that's happening right here. What can you tell me about an enzyme after it catalyzes this reaction? It can catalyze it again because an enzyme is never used up in the reaction, right? So adenylate cyclase can produce thousands of cyclic AMP molecules, all right, as a response to the binding of how many hormones? Just one. So what do we call that? When one signaling molecule can produce thousands of secondary signaling compounds somewhere else. That is what we call, amplification. Right, that's one step of amplification. All right, so then cyclic AMP is inside the cell, and it can bind to a subunit on a protein kinase, right? And this particular subunit will, in one particular example, would be inhibitory, so the protein kinase is inhibited, right? When cyclic AMP binds to it, but not just one, right? Thousands can bind to thousands of these protein kinases, and when it does, it activates, right? It activates the protein kinase. And what's the job of a protein kinase? It runs around phosphorylating other proteins inside the cell, changing their shape, changing their physiology inside the cell. All right. And what can you tell me about this protein kinase after it phosphorylates something? Is it done? No, it's an enzyme, doesn't get used up, so it will phosphorylate thousands of other molecules inside the cell. Right, and so that's another level of amplification because these enzymes don't just disappear. Okay, and as a matter of fact, there could even be more steps just like that. These active enzymes now can activate other kinds of enzymes. So what do we call it when there is a scheme with multiple levels of amplification? That's what we call a cascade mechanism. All right, and if there's a cascade mechanism, that also means, well, I guess maybe I'll ask, do you have a sense? Does that speed up a response or does that slow a response down? It speeds up, right? So that's why hydrophilic hormones can have a relatively rapid response because it has a number of amplification steps or a cascade mechanism. Right? So the response inside the cell can be rapid because of a cascade mechanism. All right, so here's just one adenylate cyclase. Now, how is the cell going to respond? What should be active inside the cell all the time? Under certain circumstances, adenylate cyclase will be activated. You don't want this cyclic AMP to be inside the cell forever. What should be active inside the cell? It is a phosphodiesterase, right? So phosphodiesterase and adenylate cyclase are antagonistic to each other. What's antagonistic to protein kinase? A protein phosphatase. That's right. Okay, so it's just the balance of these various enzymes that will eventually produce the proper concentrations of these activated compounds inside the cell. Okay, let me just read, see if I have media. Okay, that's good. Talked about that already. This is probably a good exam figure. Yeah, cyclic AMP, oh, we talked about that. Cyclic AMP is inactivated by phosphodiesterase, so the action of cyclic AMP, right, is attenuated. All right, so here is another one. So adenylate cyclase, cyclic AMP system, right, is a first messenger, second messenger system. So here we have a signal, the hormone, outside the cell, causing the development of a second messenger or another signal inside the cell. What do we call that? what do we call that? When information goes across the cell membrane, even though the signal that's outside is stuck outside. We call that signal transduction. Okay, so a signal outside the cell can be a signal inside the cell. These signals are just molecules. So here's another signal transduction scheme. Phospholipase. Okay, C, there are a number of them. Okay, but here's phospholipase C. And so cyclic AMP you learned as a second messenger. What was something else that could be used as a second messenger? Think of maybe the olfactory system. Calcium ion, right? Because where's calcium normally at a high concentration? Outside the cell, right? So if all of a sudden it builds up inside the cell, that can be used as a nice switch to activate other kinds of things because normally it is not there. All right, so here we have a hormone and it's bound to something. What is it bound to? G-protein-coupled receptor. Yeah, G-protein-coupled receptor. Here's the G-protein, here's the receptor. The receptor spans the membrane. Part of it is extracellular, part of it is intracellular, right? So that helps transduce the signal across the cell membrane. Hormone is the first messenger. It's trapped outside the cell because it is hydrophilic. G-proteins become activated, can wander around inside the cell membrane, can bump into another enzyme called phospholipase. You know it's an enzyme because why? There's an ASE on the end of it, right? And phospholipase can take a phospholipid and make another compound called inositol-3-phosphate. But we're not going to call it that. We're just going to call it IPI-3. Right? But the substrate for phospholipase, right? What is the substrate for phospholipase? It is in the name. Is a phospholipid. Now, where the heck is phospholipase ever going to find a phospholipid to make IPI-3? The plasma membrane, the structure of the plasma membrane is the substrate for phospholipase C. All right, so that's, I think that's pretty interesting. All right, so the cell membrane not only is a structure, but it's also a substrate for regulating the physiology of what's going to take place inside the cell. It has a number of roles. All right, so when IPI-3 is produced by phospholipase C, IPI-3 binds to endoplasmic reticulum, right? And you know a couple of functions for endoplasmic reticulum. One is for lipid synthesis. What's another function? It can store calcium, right? And in the cytoplasm, actually probably you should say cytosol, calcium is at a very low concentration. IPI-3 binds to the endoplasmic reticulum. That opens up calcium channels. Calcium runs right into the cytosol, and then that becomes the second messenger. Right? The first messenger is the hormone. Now, I see one step of amplification, but I don't see a cascade mechanism in this particular example. All right, so what should you know about phospholipase C? The second messenger is calcium inside the cytosol. That's how this is going to work. Okay, another kind of second messenger, maybe we'll talk about a little bit later, is diacylglycerate, and that's just what we call DAG. So DAG can be a second messenger that builds up inside the cytosol as well. And we're going to talk about some specific examples of how these things work. Okay, but both IPI-3 and DAG produce a second messenger signal called calcium. Okay. All right, so calcium, when it's released into the cytosol, has to bind to something in order to activate or inactivate it. It's got to change the shape. There are a couple kinds of molecules inside of a cell that calcium likes to bind to. And one is called troponin, which is a part of an actin molecule, right? And that's going to cause shortening of a sarcomere. Right? So calcium is important for contraction of muscle. A cousin molecule to troponin is called calmodulin. Right? When calcium binds to calmodulin, right, that calcium-calmodulin complex can activate other enzymes inside the cell, like a protein kinase, and it can phosphorylate other enzymes that will produce the effects of the hormone. And that calcium signal has to be there, so it's going to work through some kind of protein kinase. Here is what you guys have been waiting for. Do we have time? We got time to just look at this a little bit. Okay. Epinephrine. All right. Where does epinephrine come from? Most of it comes from adrenal medulla, right? Chromaffin cells and the adrenal medulla act like a postganglionic cell of the sympathetic nervous system. So epinephrine will increase sympathetic tone or sympathetic response in somebody's body. And it acts by 2-second messengers inside of a liver cell. So let's take a look at this. So epinephrine will need a certain kind of receptor. What kind of class of receptor does epinephrine need? Does it need a cholinergic receptor? No, you guys know. That's good. It needs an adrenergic receptor. And is there only one kind of adrenergic receptor? No, there's a whole bunch, right? So there's alpha and beta, and then there's alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2, and even some more. All right, so let's take a look. So we have epinephrine floating around in the extracellular space. Epinephrine is hydrophilic. So can it enter the cell? No. If it's hydrophilic, it can't. So where does the receptor of a liver cell have to be for epinephrine? It's got to be extracellular. Okay. All right, so here we have a beta adrenergic receptor. Epinephrine is going to bind to it. And through that G, and it's a G protein coupled receptor, and it can activate adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase is going to produce ATP is going to be converted into cyclic AMP. So the first messenger is epinephrine. The second messenger is cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP can activate a protein kinase. Ooh, what does a protein kinase do? It's going to phosphorylate something. And in this particular case, this protein kinase, okay, it's actually a glycogen phosphatase, right, will chop off a glucose molecule from glycogen and add a phosphate group to it because that's a kinase. So now you have glucose 1-phosphate plus whatever left of that glycogen molecule. All right, so now what could happen to this glucose 1-phosphate? It can be dephosphorylated and it can be secreted into the blood, right? When, for instance, blood glucose decreases or under conditions of stress is when epinephrine would be released in the body. All right, so here's a beta adrenergic receptor working through cyclic AMP to do what to blood glucose levels? To increase or decrease? Increase blood glucose levels, working through this second messenger system, which is a G protein coupled receptor. All right, well, here is an adrenergic receptor, all right, and when it's activated, working through a G-protein coupled receptor, it can open calcium channels in the cell membrane. Calcium will enter the liver cell. Calcium binds to calmodulin, which will activate a protein kinase, a different protein kinase, but nonetheless a protein kinase that will chop a glucose off of glycogen, add a phosphate molecule to it because it's a kinase. Okay, and so now you have the glucose 6-phosphate that becomes free glucose, which can enter, can be secreted from the liver cell. All right, so here are two different receptor mechanisms that can increase blood glucose levels. Now, what kind of enzyme is necessary for glucose 6-phosphate to become free glucose? Yeah, glucose 6-phosphatase, right? And that's probably controlled by levels of calcium inside the cell as well. Okay, so here are two receptors. Both of these are G protein coupled receptors, so this is not just an ion channel. Who's got a question about this? Yes?
I'm sorry, can you say again how that got activated, the calcium coming into the cell?
Okay, so right here, what we don't see is a G protein coupled receptor. What's a G protein coupled? Here's a G protein coupled receptor. Okay. When epinephrine binds, it's going to cause dissociation of this G protein into an alpha and then a beta and gamma. They float around inside the cell membrane. They can bump into an enzyme, in this particular case, maybe activating or in other cases turning off the enzyme. But it can bump into other things, not just enzymes. It can bump into an ion channel. And in that particular case that we were just mentioning, it bumps into a calcium channel that's normally closed. When the alpha subunit binds to that calcium channel that's normally closed, opens it up, and then what happens? calcium can enter the liver from the extracellular source. Okay, so there is that nice G protein coupled receptor right here. That's due to epinephrine binding to the G-protein coupled receptor.
Is that like a different case? Is that a different receptor?
That's a different receptor compared to one that's over here. So the other thing, so what's nifty about this slide is that both of these cases right here are G-protein coupled receptors. They both produce a second messenger, either cyclic AMP or calcium. These are both second messengers because epinephrine is where? Always outside the cell. But in this case, what's becoming activated? An enzyme is becoming activated. In this case over here, an enzyme is not being activated, but a ion channel is.
So they're not related, just showing two separate...
Just two separate kinds of signal transduction schemes. But they're both operating inside the cell. Okay, so here you have activation of an enzyme. Here you have activation of an ion channel. And so that's a pretty high-level concept. How can you change the physiology of this cell to maintain blood glucose concentration? Okay, it's through the use of these G-protein-coupled receptors and different kinds of second messengers. And in one case, it's an enzyme. In the other case, it's an ion channel. So enzymes and ion channels can change the physiology inside the cell. And I think you're all familiar, is it really important to control blood glucose levels? Yeah, so here is just a really crucial scheme for understanding blood glucose homeostasis, right? Activating an enzyme in one case, activating an ion channel in a second case, working through second messenger systems and that G-protein coupled receptor. Okay. I'm going to talk about this next time. Here is another kind of receptor. And here I see a plasma membrane. Here I see some proteins that that span the whole plasma membrane. And I see insulin. Insulin is a hydrophilic compound, can't enter the cell. Now, does this thing look like a G-protein coupled receptor to you? Not really. That's right. I see a receptor, but I don't see any G-protein. So this is another kind of receptor that we're going to talk about. It's called a tyrosine kinase receptor. Right, and we're going to start talking about that next time. Tyrosine kinase. What would you expect tyrosine kinase to do? Phosphorylate tyrosine amino acids on a protein someplace. Right, that's going to be its job. Kinase, remember, phosphorylate something. And here's insulin. So that will give you an idea how important that is. Sign-in sheet is going around.